I'm Brian Ellison, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. The future of healthcare in this country is uncertain. Republicans taking power in Washington have vowed to repeal Obamacare, but what will replace it? When? And how? Today, we'll speak with Kathy Greenlee. She served on the front lines of healthcare in the Obama administration about both the politics and the ethics of health policy. As she transitions to a new job outside of government, back here in Kansas City, we'll get her thoughts on the future of the Affordable Care Act and the current issues facing an aging America. Then, a holiday edition of the weekend to-do list, plus the local listen. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Kathy Greenlee had worked with Kathleen Sebelius for years in the Kansas governor's office, so it wasn't too surprising when she joined President Obama's first Secretary of Health and Human Services in Washington as a top official in the administration. What perhaps no one could have seen, though, would be how central a place conversations about health care and protections for Americans, including the aging and the disabled, would have in the nation's political discourse and in Obama's legacy. Or not. Now she's back in town to start a new gig at the Center for Practical Bioethics, and she's joining us today. Kathy Greenlee, welcome.
Good morning. Happy Thanksgiving. Thanks for having me here.
Well, happy Thanksgiving to you as well. I do want to talk about the new work that you're going to be doing here in Kansas City, but let's start by jumping back to 7 or 8 years ago when you got the call to go to Washington. What was it like making a transition to the big federal bureaucracy?
At the time I left, I had been working in state government for 18 years. I was looking forward to the opportunity to do national-level policy. It was exciting and quite an honor to be appointed by the president to be the Assistant Secretary for Aging. I would encourage anyone, regardless of their kind of political outlook, that if they have a chance to serve their government, serve the administration, they should do it. It's a wonderful opportunity.
Yeah, and there's something like 4,000 of those jobs that the new president gets to fill. Assistant Secretary for Aging is a very particular one of those jobs in the Health and Human Services Department. I know there's probably many facets, but in a few words, what did you do?
Well, I changed the role and expanded it while I was there. When I went, my primary responsibility was to administer Older Americans Act programs. Your listeners will know that by Meals on Wheels and the home-delivered meals. Mm-hmm. Other supports we provide to communities, including Kansas City, both sides of the state line. We changed and in 2012 created a new agency, the Administration for Community Living. We added aging disability programs together. People who are older and people who have disabilities have some similarities and differences, but certainly enough opportunity that they should be joined together in the policy and program work they do.
As you look back on those many years now of service, was there a single project that you worked on that you're really most proud of?
It's hard to pick one. I think creating the Administration for Community Living will have an ongoing legacy in this country as we talk about long-term care, how we support people as they age, people with disabilities, so they can live in their communities. My heart issue, the passion issue I have, is working on elder abuse. And I was able to lead the Obama administration efforts on elder abuse, raise the profile, and I think help move us forward with good collaboration with friends at the Justice Department. So that was my personal satisfaction, I think, as much as anything.
Did it feel like a political job, or did it feel like something different than that?
It was both. I mean, it was very much both. We're about to talk about the Affordable Care Act. You can't find something more politicized from the very beginning. The meals programs, the types of supports that I was involved with on a daily basis are less politicized. There's really a lot of agreement in this country that we should help people live in their homes.
You don't hear much talk about trying to repeal
Meals
on Wheels.
No, it's about whether we're funding them sufficiently, but it's not a philosophical objection for most people. That's not universal.
Yeah. So, well, let's talk about the Affordable Care Act then. Was that a major focus for everybody at HHS from day one?
Yes. Yes, very much. So my position as Assistant Secretary for Aging, I reported directly to Secretary Sebelius. So if you can imagine her table of senior leaders sitting next to the Surgeon General, the head of Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, it was an all-hands-on-deck from the very beginning as we all sought to find which pieces of the legislation were ours and our responsibility, and how we went about explaining to the American public what it was. As the Assistant Secretary for Aging, some of the early changes to the ACA were some additional benefits to Medicare. So some of my work was almost front-loaded at the beginning of the administration more than the back.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people think about the ACA and they think about it as separate from Medicare, that Obamacare deals with people before they get on Medicare.
But there were changes to Medicare, some additional preventative services benefits that went into effect right away. And everyone knows about, or most people know about, the donut hole. Closing the gap between what people get coverage for was a big part of the ACA in the beginning.
So once it did pass Congress, once President Obama signed it, you had to go about the work of building something, right? How did that come to be? How talk us through kind of that process, at least as you witnessed it.
On the inside of the administration, I mean, you don't just watch a piece of legislation that's this massive and then wait till it arrives before you figure it out. There were teams of people from the beginning, before the law was signed, who were analyzing which section of the law, which agency would have responsibility for. I mean, who does this piece? You have to really go through such a massive piece of legislation and figure out which agency has responsibility and then drill down from there. I worked on one piece of the law that was the Community Living Assistance Supports and Services, it's a mouthful, the CLASS Act, which was meant to design a limited benefit long-term care policy that we ultimately figured out couldn't work, and it was repealed. So that's an example. We divided up the work and drilled down from there.
Mm-hmm. Now, as you said, the Affordable Care Act was politicized from the very beginning. I can't think of other pieces of major legislation like this that were followed immediately by efforts to repeal them year in, year out to such an extent. How did that affect the implementation of the work?
Well, when you say you can't remember, it may also be a function of our age. Social Security and Medicare certainly was a national universal coverage program, and when it was implemented, I don't know that it was politicized on the back end, but certainly there had been a lot of political conversation before Medicare was adopted. What that did for us, I'll give you just a personal example for me. I arrived in Washington as the Assistant Secretary for Aging a month before the death panel summers, when there was so much foment around the country about kind of a misunderstood aspect of the law. So from the beginning, it was about trying to get ahead of a conversation that had become so politicized to get factual information in front of the American public. And that was hard to do.
And so what did you do? How did you take your message directly to the public?
There wasn't a single message. And I think that was a challenge with the Affordable Care Act from the very beginning. What I would go talk about with Medicare is different than someone would talk about with regard to buying health insurance on a marketplace or exchange. So we all had to come up with a message that we needed to take to our particular constituencies or audiences.
So you did this for all of these years, and it came. You're obviously with everyone else thinking, well, our days here are numbered. When did you actually leave your position at HHS?
I left at the end of July.
Okay, and was that a difficult thing to do?
Yes and no. I had been there for 7 years, which is a long time in the life of a political appointee. I had achieved as much as I thought I could, was ready to go, but was sad to leave. It was a wonderful opportunity, and frankly, it was nice to be that close to the ocean. So I liked being on the East.
So you will actually miss it.
I will.
But I guess you get to come back to your home.
Yes.
I think you are actually the first departing Democratic appointee that we've had on the show as this transition really is now getting underway. What's it like to be handing power over to the people who opposed a good deal of what you were working for?
I realize this. I watch the conversation about what's likely to happen, that I'm well-informed and have a vested interest in what happens next. For me, I am a Democrat, a political appointee. I don't want to be overly partisan this morning. That's not my goal. I have worked with Republicans. I had this line I used to use. I'm a Democrat from Kansas. I've always worked with Republicans. Yeah. I'm just looking for people who are seriously interested in the benefit of the American people and want to leave and bring good ideas and find some common ground. I think that would help us all.
Well, we do want to invite our listeners today to be part of our conversation and specifically to ask questions that you may have about Obamacare, about the Affordable Care Act. Are you worried about what will happen next? Are you glad to see it go? Do you have things that you're confused about or experiences to share? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. Share your questions and comments with us. We'd love to hear from you. You can also tweet at us. We're at KCUR Up to Date. We're talking with Kathy Greenlee. She's left the Department of Health and Human Services now. She's just getting started as Vice President for Aging and Health Policy at the Center for Practical Bioethics here in Kansas City. I want to dig in now to the Affordable Care Act. And there's been a lot of conversation around this, Kathy. President-elect Trump has vowed that he will repeal Obamacare. Can he do that?
I would like to answer your question by starting in 2009, which will seem like a departure, but I would like to go back and remind our listeners about what an unusual circumstance it was that brought us the law in the first place. We had Democratic control of the House and the Senate and the presidency. And in the Senate, at that time, we had 60 votes. And the Senate works in a very different way from what most people know. To pass a law in the Senate, you need 60 votes. To pass a budget, you need 50. And the reason for the difference is it takes 60 votes to stop talking about the law and move it to the floor to vote on it. For a nanosecond, quite literally a few months, the Democrats had a supermajority. Then Senator Kennedy died, and his replacement was Scott Brown, who's a Republican, and the Democrats lost their supermajority. So they quickly passed it on Christmas Eve. What we have now may look like the same scenario where you have Republicans in charge of the House, the Senate, and Congress, and the presidency, but they don't have a supermajority in the Senate, which means as we move forward, there will be differences in how they approach changing the law. It came in one fell swoop. It won't leave by that same path.
Well, and what that means, of course, is that there will have to be some new solutions or things that replace particular elements of it along the way. It doesn't just simply return to the way things were before, right?
Right. So I think of it, and I think the best way to describe it to the general public is to pass a law, you need 60 votes. To fund the law, you need 50. So there are many things that a Republican-controlled Congress can do quickly. I mean, budget's not usually a quick process, to starve the law of the money it needs to run. And that's the best way to think about it, that this Congress and this new president will look to start repealing the budget aspects, the Medicaid expansion money, the subsidies for people who buy insurance. They could decide we're not going to penalize anybody if they don't buy it. There are things that can quickly move, but it won't change the law. The law will still be there, sort of ineffective if it's not funded. But to replace that law with a new law, you will need 60 votes.
And what would be the implications of reducing that funding? Would there be an immediate effect?
What I've been reading, and I've been watching this closely since President-elect Trump was elected, is that most people think the results would not be seen until most likely 2018, that people who've purchased coverage for 2017 are probably safe, meaning that they'll have it for a full year. Mm-hmm. And because we're talking about using a budget mechanism, it'll also follow a budget cycle for when the federal money could start to dry up. But it'll be a budget approach to start dismantling the law.
And so if you had to sort of put on your political prognostication hat here, even President-elect Trump has said that some of the elements of the Affordable Care Act simply can't be undone, that he doesn't want to undo them. Do you think we're heading for another long, complicated round here of trying to rebuild the whole way we do healthcare in the country?
Yes. Yeah, and I've been reading Kaiser News Services. I mean, some of the publications coming out of D.C. that are nonpartisan, they call it like the dog that caught the car, that now what are you going to do with it? There are parts of the law that the president-elect said he liked that are well-loved by the American public, keeping kids on their parents' health plans till 26, eliminating pre-existing conditions. Insurance companies can't. They have to take you if you've been sick. And removing lifetime caps. Those are challenging issues to keep in the law, as you deal with making sure that the insurance is affordable, available. What to replace it with will be a hard conversation. The Republicans have been floating some ideas. There's some things that they will look to do, but they're not necessarily the same things as what do you do about keeping pre-existing conditions off the table.
Well, let's take some questions from our listeners and see what they're thinking about when they talk about Affordable Care Act and about the possible repeal of Obamacare. 816-235-2888. That's the number to call if you have questions or comments for Kathy Greenlee, formerly the Assistant Secretary for Aging at Health and Human Services. Jackie is calling from Kansas City, Missouri. Yep. Hi, Jackie.
Hold on. Yes, my question is about the Plan D donut hole that you mentioned earlier. Has that been closed, or is that going to be closed in 2017?
Is the donut hole closed? Just help us, give us a quick summary, Kathy, of what is the donut hole that people talk about?
An accurate answer would give you numbers that I don't have in my head, but I can explain the concept. When someone has the prescription drug program, Medicare Part D, as the caller talks about, the federal government through Medicare will pay for a lot of the costs, and then there's a gap. Think of it as a big hole you have to jump over, a donut hole. So it's described thinking of a donut. And then they get coverage again at a catastrophic level. That's caused a real hardship for people on Medicare because suddenly they have to go later in the year with very little coverage. Ma'am, I believe that the plan was that the donut hole would be closed by 2020. I'm not certain of that, but I don't think we're quite there. It was meant to close it gradually over a series of years.
Does that answer your question, Jackie?
You bet. Thank you so much.
Thank you for calling. Now, do you think, Kathy, that was the plan before changes were made to the existing laws? That could all be up in the air now.
Yes, it could be.
Let's talk to Jim in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Jim.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. My question is, with all the concern over everything that's in the ACA, originally the administration had wanted to link the ACA, maybe before it was called the ACA, through either Medicare or Medicaid. And I believe Senator Lieberman voted against it, and we ended up what we have now. My question is, would the implementation and some of the possible problems have been alleviated had that other plan or a game plan been implemented where it would have been linked closer to either Medicare or Medicaid?
So let me describe what the path was that we didn't take as a country. We could have decided to expand Medicaid to increase the eligibility to cover more people through Medicaid. The conversation about that would have quickly moved to cost to expand Medicaid. We could have chosen to expand Medicare, so coverage for older adults and some people with disabilities. That conversation would also quickly turn to cost. I think there still would have been kind of a working class individual needing access to affordable insurance. There still would have been large sections of the public that didn't get either of those two programs, because I don't see a conversation that would have built something so that there was full coverage through Medicare and Medicaid. Those are likely to come back into the conversation, but they will sound different. That what many of the Republican proposals are at this point are to turn Medicaid completely over to the states, which means states would make decisions and we would have less uniformity, and there's not a lot of uniformity now. And whether or not we should continue to look at universal coverage. And I think Senator Sanders and some of the champions who'd been talking about that previously will bring that up again.
Appreciate your call, Jim. 816-235-2888 is the number to call. Richard from Kansas City is with us. Hi, Richard.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I like the ACA, at least up to this point. That's how I get my insurance. I'm self-employed. I'm an artist. I am fortunate to qualify for the, you know, through taxes to cut the cost down a little bit, but my rates are doubling this year for the same coverage I had last year. But what my question is, I don't understand why the people that have their insurance through the ACA have to be separated out into their own pool of risk. And to me, that's where the weakness of the program lies. Some states, the insurers are pulling out, and it's, you know, it looks to me like it's in a death spiral. When it's the same insurance companies involved. So here I am, an individual. I buy my insurance through the ACA. Let's say a company like Blue Cross Blue Shield or Aetna or whoever. Right across the street is somebody else that works for a large company that also gets their insurance coverage through one of those same insurance companies. Why are we not all in the same pool, since the same insurance companies providing coverage to spread that risk out, why does the ACA have to be separated out by state and into separate pools where we're probably going to, you know, collapse? Because, I mean, a number of states only have one or two insurance cover providers doing the coverage anymore and just don't have large enough pools.
Yeah, it's a good question, Richard. Let me ask Kathy Greenlee to give that a shot.
And the premise that you started with, that your rates are going up, is a sincere problem. I mean, Democrats and Republicans all agree.
And not something that was anticipated, right, Kathy?
Because we haven't had enough participation from people who are healthy. Mm-hmm. You know, the younger people, that you need to make them buy the insurance, which is sort of the center of this whole argument. Our caller brings up two different issues, if I could just kind of quickly talk about them. One is what he talks about, why am I in a separate risk pool? So health insurance is regulated at the state level, and insurance companies sell state by state. Part of what the president-elect has been talking about when he says, I'd like to erase the lines between the states, he proposes that by doing that, we would have more competition. And I can understand the logic of wanting more competition in a Kansas City metropolitan region. That's kind of easy to see. It becomes challenging when you think about what health insurance actually does. I just moved from the state of Maryland. I really don't want to use, as a Kansas resident, the Maryland provider network that was a part of my Maryland insurance plan.
Right.
So when you think about providers, health insurance is delivered locally. So you may have a national company, but they're really putting together networks state by state by state. And that's where the complications come in when you talk about erasing the lines. But the caller's reference also talked about someone living across the street for a big company. Major companies, huge companies, I'll just use Kansas City Sprint because it's so large, they don't actually hire an insurance company to do the insurance business. They hire an insurance company to manage the business that the company's already running. They
right.
self-fund the insurance.
Right. They just manage the
and
claims.
And so may have, the caller and the neighbor may have two Blue Cross Blue Shield of Kansas City or another health plans may look alike. But one may be insured and the other may be a self-funded plan from a company. And those don't fall under the ACA. They have, they're governed by rules that deal with the Department of Labor and large federal plans.
That's helpful clarification. I guess I do wonder, Kathy, you've seen it from the inside. You've been right in the thick of it. Nobody thinks the program is perfect. It hasn't worked out in all the ways that everyone hoped. If you were president-elect, what would you want to be changing in this plan right now?
Well, I think, you know, I think bizarre. I mean, this is kind of an odd political season, and it's really easy to get distracted by all of the volatility of the kind of the politics. In the middle of all of this is a sincere desire: how do we make insurance available and affordable to as many people as possible? That's a real issue, and the complication is making it work financially and actuarially. And the Democrats and Republicans have different answers, I think.
Well, let's take a break, and maybe we can get to some of those answers as we continue. You're welcome to give us a call at 816-235-2888 as we continue our conversation with Kathy Greenlee. We'll take a look at the work she's beginning now here in Kansas City. What are the ethical issues raised around how society cares for the sick and the aging and those with disabilities? We'll unpack health policy, and we'll take more of your calls. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. Welcome back to the second half of Up to Date. I'm Brian Ellison in for Steve Kraske. Yesterday on the program, we talked about the Learning Club's helpful impact on children in KCK and also about recent efforts to decriminalize marijuana in Missouri. You can find those conversations at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, Up to Date, we'll be enjoying the holiday, but you can tune in for American Public Media's documentary on the challenges that some of the nation's poorest high schools and their students face when it comes to dropping out. Today, though, we're back with Kathy Greenlee. She's just left a job in the Obama administration to become Vice President of Aging and Health Policy at the Center for Practical Bioethics here in town. If you have questions for her about health policy, whether it's the Affordable Care Act or policies around aging and people with disabilities, you can give us a call at 816-235-2888. We've been focusing on the Affordable Care Act, and we actually have one more question from a caller about that. Cindy in Overland Park is with us. Hi, Cindy.
Hello. Hi.
Hi, Cindy.
How are you?
Good.
Cindy, what's your question for Kathy?
My question is, do you think that it might cause some resentment among people to have some people pay let's say, $1,200 through the exchange, while other people like myself paying over $12,000 for the same coverage? And do you realize how economically painful that has been?
Cindy, it sounds like you're answering your own question. There is some resentment about that. Is that fair to say?
I don't mind paying a little extra. I do mind paying 10 times more.
Yeah, what do you say to people like Cindy, Kathy?
That making insurance affordable is the hardest piece of this puzzle. The reason why people get a subsidy is because they qualify as needing it financially. If you fall outside of that, then you're paying rates like Cindy, I believe Cindy rates that she's telling me about.
Mm-hmm.
When we talk about what's likely to happen in the future, and I keep describing that if it's related to the budget, they'll attack that first in terms of a strategy. It's likely that the person's getting the subsidy is the person who will first, you know, likely lose the subsidy. And that doesn't end up with either people paying a rate that's affordable and sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
How do we have a rate that everyone can afford and make sure that everyone gets into the pool? If only people who are using insurance are the people who are in the pool, the insurance is very expensive.
Is that just an actuarial question, Kathy? Or is, I mean, Cindy's question sort of suggests that there's a philosophical, emotional element to that question as well.
There's all kinds of politics around all of this and different strategies. But at the base, a caller talked about a death spiral. If you're having insurance, you have to have a blend of people in the plan, whether it's risky drivers who are driving a car and needing a blend of safe drivers, or health insurance where you need people of various degrees of health or sickness in the plan. I mean, it's just the basics of spreading a risk across populations. And for health insurance, it's very hard to do because the people who need it the most really need it, and they're very expensive.
Let's take one more call on health care. Jack is with us from Shawnee. Hi, Jack.
Yes, good morning. I'm a healthcare consultant. I do a lot of consulting for hospital businesses. I see firsthand how much money these hospitals tend to make. It tends to be a good deal of profit in the industry. And also the doctors are making a good deal of money and the pharmaceutical companies are making a good deal of money. I think we need to cut out the insurance altogether. We need single payer. We need single payer. It'd be cheaper overall. You wouldn't be paying insurance premiums. You're paying taxes for it, but it'd be a better deal.
Yeah, I appreciate the question, Jack. I mean, Kathy, there were certainly some in government who supported the idea of a single-payer health plan. Why did that not come to be?
It's just not something that has enough political support to make it happen. It would completely transform and change the way we deliver services and care. I mean, I have spent 25 years in public service. I tend to have this opinion that I think government can run programs effectively. As the general public, I don't know, shares that opinion. But run something with less administrative overhead
Medicare
than a for-profit company.
Medicare is a single-payer health plan.
Yes.
The VA is a single-payer health plan. It can be done in other areas, but it's just a matter of not having the political support.
Doesn't have the political support.
Fair enough. Let's move on from the ACA, and thanks, Jack, for the call. But to talk a little bit about the rest of your work, both in government, Kathy, and now here at the Center for Practical Bioethics, which is with the aging, a particular focus on the elderly. If you had to sort of give us the quick overview of what you think are the biggest issues facing the elderly in America today, what do you point to?
I would point to the determination of all of us as an aging population to live our lives under our sort of direction in our homes and in our communities, that we're finding more and more people who simply say, I don't want to move someplace else, I want to stay right here. And we as a society need to figure out how to provide those services. It's good economic policy. It's good people policy because people want to stay engaged in the places they've been. It's less expensive to provide services there. But we don't have systems in place that are easy to navigate for people as they figure out how to stay home and age in place.
And is this a conversation about what the federal government should be doing, or is this a state government? Is this a local? Is this a family and charities issue?
I would pick E, all of the above.
Okay.
I mean, it's really I think as a society we're placing increased value on this outcome. I want to stay in my community. One of the issues in aging that flummoxes me, and I've been handling hard issues, is transportation. And then how does everybody get to the doctor if they're 85, no longer driving, sitting in either a suburb here in Kansas City or downtown or in rural parts of either of these two states? How do they get around? You know, it's complicated to figure out what it really takes to help someone achieve those goals, but I think it's worth it. I think the quality of life that people expect at the end of life is improving and something that we're placing more emphasis on.
And are these issues becoming bigger issues now because people are living longer, or are they becoming bigger issues for more than just that reason?
I think it's because people are living longer, but it's there's an aspect of aging. We all know that we're living longer, this longevity dividend. And what we're getting from that is a different experience in life between the ages of 50 and 75. The more active younger people, the more active younger seniors, I don't know how best to describe them, where you have people who still have engagement, things they want to do. This concept of turning 65 and getting a watch and retiring is gone.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that experience, because of the vibrancy of those years, people say, there's no reason why I'm 80. I have to do something different. And I think the whole experience of getting to old age has changed to the degree that the old age experience by itself will change as well.
So you're taking on this new job at the Center for Practical Bioethics, Vice
Yes.
President for Aging at a really interesting time. And it's interesting to me that it's lodged in this place that talks about ethics, that talks about the philosophical issues, not just policy issues. How much do you think about health policy in those ethical and not just political terms?
Well, the other thing that the center talks about that people don't really talk about, and even in aging, is end of life and death, as we really would like to pretend like that's not going to happen. But I think the movement of all of us about what does quality mean must extend to the end of life and advanced illness experience, that how do we do this well as a society? What the center really focuses on is promoting policies and practice so that people's wishes are recognized, that we actually really, really encourage people to have conversations about what they want for their lives so that government isn't in the middle of it, that families and people can make these decisions about what they want as they age and as they die. And that will increase the experience for everyone sort of in the life of the older person or the person who's dying. And that's what the center is focusing on. How do we get practices in place that really respect the individual and their wishes to the very last breath?
I know your background is as an attorney. Do you think these are questions that will be resolved in legal arenas in the coming years, or are these more just individual decisions that you need to give people the tools to think about?
I see them as three circles in a Venn diagram. See circles that overlap.
Okay.
We need to have conversations with the healthcare sector and talk about, I have this advanced illness. What's likely to happen to me? Let me make some realistic decisions about what happens at the end stages of cancer or Alzheimer's disease. You need the medical professionals. There are legal aspects to this as well, because many of the documents you put in place are legal documents. But then there's the human element. Maybe it's the elephant.
Elephant in the room.
The human element, where people need to really reflect their faith traditions, their sense of community, their values as a family. It's not all doctors and lawyers. It's about people and their values, which at some point need to just be private conversations with them and the people that they love about how to make things work for them to the very end.
So day to day, your job will be very different than it used to be. You won't be sitting there with a $1.9 billion budget. You'll be sitting at a desk or talking to people on the phone. How different will that be for you to be on the outside of the policymaking looking in?
It will be very different. And as much as anything, I am going through a career change myself. I've spent 25 years, like I said, in public service. What's the best value I can add to society? Because I'm very mission-driven. As I move into the future and continue to be an advocate for good policies and good programs.
That's Kathy Greenlee. She's the new Vice President for Aging and Health Policy at the Center for Practical Bioethics, ending time spent in the Obama administration. Kathy, it's really good to have you here. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for your interest. Everybody watch. It'll be wild.
Yeah, we can hardly wait. And maybe we'll have you back, too.
Thank you.
Coming up, Brian McTavish with a holiday edition of our weekend to-do list. You got to know.
Sitting at the table, there'll be time enough for counting when the dealing's done. Every gambler knows that the secret to surviving is knowing what to throw away, knowing
Cause every hand's a winner, and every hand's a loser.
And speaking of winners, not of losers, joining us is KCUR contributor Brian McTavish, who follows and writes about pop culture and joins us in the studio each week with some good ideas for the weekend.
Yeah.
Brian, it's good to see you.
Oh, it's good to see you, Brian.
And Kenny Rogers, that is a great voice to hear on our airwaves.
It really is. It really is. And he will continue to be a favorite of many over the airwaves, but not so much on the concert stage,
this
Brian.
This is it, huh?
I think this really is it. You know,
can I tell the truth? I'm surprised he was still on the concert stage anyway.
He's traveling around the world at age 78 on his Gambler's Last Deal Christmas and Hits Tour. Yes, you'll get some Christmas songs if you show up, and you should. We should at 7:30 Friday night, day after Thanksgiving, at Silverstein Eye Center's Arena. This is a fella, Kenny Rogers. He's enjoyed more than 60 years in the show business, right? Including his first chart hit in 1958, That Crazy Feeling. And that's just one of more than 120 hit songs on the country, pop, rock, and adult contemporary charts. He sold more than 120 million records, Brian.
What's your favorite one? Is it The Gambler? Is that why we're listening to it?
Well, I have a soft spot for The Gambler. It's one of the greatest country music story songs ever, actually. But my favorite came out in 1968, just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in, right? He cut that as the leader of the first edition back in his rock and roll days. It was later used nicely, extremely nicely used during a dream sequence in the 1998 cult film classic The Big Lebowski, right? Wow. But it was in the late 70s and early 80s that he really hit his stride with Lucille and Lady and Love Will Turn You Around, always like that
when
one.
When you've been around this long, you've done pretty much everything at some point.
Except retire.
And now
time.
He's doing that.
That's right. He's going to put on just a fine and dandy show, I'm sure. And as he recently told the Branson Tri-Lakes News, because Rogers performs Saturday in Branson and they want to get the word out too, that once he gets off the road, he's, quote, most looking forward to spending time with his twin boys who are 12 years old now.
I read that in the Branson Tri-Lakes News just the other day. 7:30 on Friday, Kenny Rogers.
You betcha.
May you build a ladder to the stars and climb on every rung. May you stay. Forever young.
Oh, and speaking of forever young, back to Brian McTavish.
Oh, back to Brian Ellison. You look pretty good yourself,
thank
kiddo.
Thank you, Brian.
Well, thank you, Brian. This is habit forming, I think.
But Joan Baez is not coming to Kansas City.
In spirit. Okay, right now at the National Museum of Toys and Miniatures at UMKC, just a stone's throw from here, they have Forever Young, a Victorian Photographs of Children and Their Toys exhibit, right? Well, in conjunction with that, on the day after Thanksgiving, this is really cool, from 10 to 4 on Friday, go to the museum and you can take part in a family-friendly workshop called Darling Daguerreotypes. And that's what daguerreotypes, 1840s, 50s preceded the photograph, I guess.
Right.
And way back when in these Victorian photographs, kids were often posed with their prized toys, right?
Huh.
So on this day after Thanksgiving event, you can bring your favorite toy, or perhaps you can choose from the museum's collection of toys and have your snapshot taken. It'll look just like an old-timey photograph. Now, if I had my picture taken, you know what I would do? I'd bring the little tin funnel I had when I was 5 years old that I would put on my head and pretend to be the cartoon character Tom Terrific. You remember Tom Terrific?
I don't.
Well, I'm older than you, Brian, so
yes,
you win. But
you are.
What favorite toy would you bring, Brian? Hey, we were old kids once. I bet they let us do it for $5.
You know what I loved?
What?
My favorite toy was the Mr. Game Show electronic game. Do you remember this?
No.
It was a talking man. He was like animatronic. He would move, but he would have all the insults and say, "Hello and welcome to Mr. Game Show."
Well,
it's actually where I also got my career ambitions.
I think one thing leads to another.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely.
10 to 4 on Friday at the National Museum of Toys and Miniatures. Mm-hmm. Moving on, though, a little something different rolling into town this weekend.
Oh, that's very well put. Yes, rolling into town, as you say, is Henry Rollins, right?
Oh,
he's going to give a spoken word performance.
Clever.
You are. A spoken word performance by none other than Henry Rollins. He's the formerly angry, cynical young man of the 1980s hardcore punk band Black Flag. He's now a very thoughtful author, newspaper columnist, screen actor, TV and radio host. He's basically reinvented himself. He used to get in fights with the audience, you know, punching and kicking and spitting and scratching, right? But these days, he has a totally different relationship to the audience. And what do you say we listen to what he has to say about his current relationship with the fans?
Let's do it.
And so the audience reaction to me, I don't care about applause or laughter. It's a connection you make where you literally feel like you are stopping time. And so there's moments on stage where you're just like, the whole world is just waiting, you know, for the next thing to happen. And we're all waiting for it together. And there's these magic moments on stage. You're like, this is bigger than all of us in this building. And I'm not saying I'm the proponent of that. I'm just saying we're all in this collective moment together. But to be aware of it and to some degree kind of being the ringmaster of it, it's a lot of pressure. And thankfully, I don't take myself seriously, but I take the audience real seriously. I really fear failing them. I love them so much. They have no idea.
Remind us when Henry Rollins is performing.
I will indeed. He is performing at 8 o'clock Friday night at the Uptown Theater, and he'll be a very nice gentleman telling about his life and times.
Be sure to see Brian's 6 post-turkey things to do in Kansas City this weekend. That's at kcur.org. What do we have here, Brian?
Okay, we have the Thanksgiving breakfast dance, right? It's
yes.
At 10 o'clock. When else but Thanksgiving tomorrow, Thursday, at the Kansas National Guard Armory.
I didn't realize you could dance at breakfast time.
Well, you can if they serve liquor. Actually, they're not serving liquor. It's BYOB.
Oh, well.
Do not bring your own blues. Bring your own booze, if you so desire. Kool-Aid's
good.
Okay, or maybe some 7-Up or something. It's a blues bash, 10 o'clock Thursday, KCK National Guard Armory. They'll feed you. You'll have to provide your own liquid, but Theodius Ely, Trampled Underfoot, Millage Gilbert, and Lady Vivian Wilson will be there. Sounds like fun.
Excellent start to the day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if you don't get enough fun on Thanksgiving Day, there's
right.
more to do.
It just keeps coming on this holiday weekend roundup. It's the Rainmakers, Kansas City favorites, returning for their annual Thanksgiving weekend gig, 7 o'clock Friday at the Record Bar, and that's Let My People Go Go, one of a handful of hits that actually did pretty well on the charts for the band in the mid-1980s. They started out in 1983 as a trio called Steve, Bob, and Rich. Then they got signed to PolyGram Records, a major label. They added Pat Tomic on drums, with freeing up lead singer Bob Walkenhorst, who runs and walks.
Yes.
He'll be running on stage, I'm sure, this weekend to sort of become a sort of a rock star. They were on the cover of Rolling Stone. Can you believe? No, they had a fashion piece in Rolling Stone. Anyway, check them out this weekend at the Record Bar.
Very good. Enough with the music. This is what people want to do on their holiday weekend.
Are you ready to wrestle?
Well, not here, actually, no.
Okay, it's the WWE Live Holiday Tour, and you're going to get a bunch of wrestlers at 7:30 Saturday at the Sprint Center, including AJ Styles and Dean Ambrose and Kane and Alexa Bliss and Dolph Ziggler and The Miz and Bray Wyatt and a bunch of others. But get this, Kansas City's own non-wrestling sensation, Rob Schomburger, he is the official Kansas City local guy. He's the official World Wrestling Entertainment artist. He paints up a storm. He'll be at this wrestling event at 7:30 Saturday at Sprint Center. Shake his hand and get his autograph.
Get your tickets now.
It's beginning to look a lot like Christmas.
And because it's almost Thanksgiving, it's starting to look like Christmas,
apparently. That's right. It's the 20th annual Christmas in the Sky holiday stage show and fireworks spectacular tonight from 6 to 8 at Longview Lake Beach. And then what, tomorrow night? It's the time-honored kickoff to the Kansas City holiday season, the 87th annual Plaza Lighting Ceremony from 5 to 8 at the Country Club Plaza.
We had to end there, didn't we?
We did.
Well,
we
I'm glad we did. That's Brian McTavish with the weekend to-do list, an extended holiday version. Brian, always good to see you.
Do not hold back on the dressing tomorrow. It always treats you right.
I'm going to take your advice. And we're not done yet. There's more fun to head into the long weekend with. KCUR contributor Bill Brownlee is in the studio for our local listen. Hello, Bill.
Hello.
It's great to see you. And what would you like for us to consider this holiday weekend?
Well, my friend Brian McTavish accepted. You know, a lot of my buddies these days are blue, you know, whether it's recent events or the time change that imposes early darkness on us. They're down. But whenever they tell me about the problems, I say, I have the answer. It's the new Chris Hazleton album, Soul Jazz Fridays.
And Chris Hazleton leads a group, right?
Right. He has a group called Boogaloo 7. They play every Friday night at the Green Lady Lounge. Chris Hazleton, the leader, plays Hammond B3 organ.
Well, let's at least get started by giving that a listen. Love the Hammond B3.
Yeah, it's a really a happy sound, and the new album, has that uplifting vibe, but there's also artistic depth to the music.
And so, what is this piece called?
This piece is called the Grand Avenue Get Down, a reference, of course, to the jazz venue.
That's our Grand Avenue.
On Grand, right?
Very good. So, I know you've got a review of this, by the way, up online right now at kcur.org. Tell me more about Hazleton and this jazz organ that he plays.
Yeah, the Green Lady Lounge's house sound is organ based. So Hazleton, a young guy, plays the instrument at least once a week there, including every Friday night. A slightly older guy named Ken Laverne plays the organ at the Green Lady one or two nights a week with his OJT. But Hazleton has been doing it for more than 2 years every Friday night with this band, the Boogaloo 7. He's got this 1960s throwback sound, but because it's so fun and filled with joy, it doesn't sound stale or musty, even though he's studiously reviving a sound that was most popular 50 years ago.
Are these older guys? Were they playing? Have they been playing a long time? Or are these younger guys?
Chris is 31, I think, and most of his band are guys about his age. So yeah, they weren't even around when this was at its peak, but which I think allows them to bring freshness to it.
Bill, if listeners want to check out more of his music, what's the name of this album?
The name of the album is Soul Jazz Fridays. There is, as you said, a brand new review up at kcur.org.
That's KCUR contributor Bill Brownlee with our local listen. Bill, it's always a pleasure.
Thank you, Brian.
And you can listen to previous programs or download our podcasts at kcur.org/up-to-date. Don't forget you can follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR up-to-date. I'm at PTS Brian. Hey, tomorrow we'll be pouring cream of mushroom soup over green beans and so on, but you can tune in at 11 anyway for a documentary on how some of the nation's poorest high schools are raising their graduation rates. Up to date, we'll be back on Monday. Our theme music is composed by Bobby Watson. We had help this week from KCUR's Linda Scher, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, Ryan Hennessy, and Corinne Dorian. Our senior producer is Steven Steigman, and Steve Kraske will be back on Monday. Have a great Thanksgiving, everyone. It's been good to be with you. I'm Brian Ellison, and you are up to date.